Welcome to Blueprint to Boom, your plan for taking a small idea and building something big. Hello and welcome to Blueprint to Boom, the podcast for small and medium enterprises in the UK. In fact, welcome to the last episode of season one of Blueprint to Boom. Now, because of a slight technical problem, scheduling changed slightly. When we did the last recording, I said that we would not be broadcasting after the budget, but the budget has now dropped. More on that in a minute. As with every episode, we have brought a guest to the studio today who we think has something to contribute to small businesses. And I'm absolutely thrilled that my guest today is a real bona fide Royal Navy captain, in brackets, retired, my great friend Chris Groves. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
So we are going to crack straight on with the shock interview. Okay, so as with every episode, we're going to subject our guest to a bit of a fun shock interview, just some silly questions so that you can start to get to know Chris as well as I do. But Chris, imagine you're in a job interview and you're being asked questions that you would never be asked in a job interview. But first of all, tell us just a little bit about your career and what you've been doing for the last few years.
Well, I joined the Navy in 1987, straight from school. Went to Dartmouth as an officer, as a warfare officer, used to be called executive officer. So those that do navigation and run the executive elements of a ship and end up commanding ships or submarines. And so I did a career spanning 30 years, which was predominantly in the submarine service. I commanded a nuclear attack submarine, HMS Torbay, and then went on in my career to do a number of really important and crunchy sort of staff jobs. So a lot of leadership, a lot of training, a lot of command experience and staff experience working with the higher levels of defence. And a great lot of fun along the way.
And something we will touch upon later, although this is not the focus of the interview, you're in a very special role right now, aren't you?
I am. And it's really through my time in the Navy, and my career in the Navy, in which I find myself as the master tin plate worker, alias wire worker, of the City of London. So it's a livery company, one of the 113 livery companies that exist in the square mile in the City of London. And the purpose of these livery companies used to be around regulation of trade and guilds and looking after quality control of various crafts and trades and the way that people looked after their employees and making sure they were paid enough and trying to keep the standards up. And then those guilds sort of got taken over by more international regulatory bodies, and so they still exist now to look after their trades and promote their trades and do a load of charity work and a lot of fellowship as well. So it's great fun.
I will touch a little bit more on that later. All right, so some silly interview questions. So you've commanded submarines, but how would you handle a team of millennials armed with unlimited coffee?
Well, I've done a little bit of that. In subsequent roles, the one thing I would say about millennials, they are still hugely capable individuals, and so if I look at the new joiners that are joining the submarine service now, and I still dip back in and see them, they're hugely capable. They're different, you know. They have different needs. They've grown up in a world that is more connected. They have different expectations. But that doesn't mean they can't absolutely deliver, you know, in stressful conditions. And they're still just as motivated. They're just motivated in some slightly different ways, I think.
That's really interesting. And a good lesson for business owners who, you know, certainly our generation, who might shake their heads a little bit at some of the way that things have changed over the last 20 or 30 years. But change is not necessarily a bad thing, I think, is the point you're trying to make there.
Yeah.
If you disagreed with senior management, would you torpedo the idea or attempt diplomatic manoeuvres first?
It would depend who the manager was. It would depend how important the subject was, I think. If you can do things through diplomacy, it's always the best way of achieving it. And it's half the skill and fun of the game is in managing up and down, I think, is how you get things done. There's a place for torpedoing without a doubt. There is a place for torpedoing, you know, and if a suggestion is crass or dangerous, for example, then absolutely torpedo is the way ahead.
What's the longest amount of time you've gone without seeing daylight? And are you happy, therefore, to take command of our basement office?
I've done about 12 weeks, you know, submerged without seeing
just shy of 3 months.
So, yeah, 3 months in a submarine, dived without coming back up to the surface.
That's a long time.
It's a long time, but, and I think this is a lesson for when you're in austere conditions or when you're working and the pressure's on, keep people busy. You know, keep them motivated. Make sure that they're recognised for what they're doing. And I found working in a submarine was a little bit like working in an office with no windows, in many ways. So, like your basement. And fundamentally, you're so busy. You're working 6 hours on, 6 hours off, 6 hours on, 6 hours off. From the minute you leave the harbour wall to the minute you come back to the harbour wall. So that could be for 12 or, you know, 14 or 16 weeks in some cases. But if you focus on the job in hand, you do the 6 hours, 6 hours worth of work. You've only got 6 hours then before you're back on work again. That's to sleep, to eat, to recreate in whatever way you're going to recreate. And it's not a lot of time. And the hours go really quickly.
Did that? I'm asking now just out of interest, because I think this is quite interesting. I mean, when I was in the police, I did what was called the Ottawa shift system. But obviously, that's nothing like 6 hours on, 6 hours off. Why do they do it that way? Is there science behind that?
There is some science behind it. And we've looked at all sorts of things, circadian rhythm and how people react to different working routines. There are lots of factors that you need to take into account, I think. When you first go to sea for that first few days, it takes a bit of getting used to.
Yeah.
You know, people are more tired than perhaps they would ordinarily be. But in reality, you very quickly get used to the routine.
Your rhythm
and
gets
your rhythm
into
gets
it.
Into
yeah.
it. And I could exist on about 4 hours worth of sleep.
Really?
A night.
I'm a nightmare if I don't get my 8 hours.
Yeah. No, well, you never get 8 hours.
My Apple Watch says different.
Yeah, in a submarine you never get 8 hours. And actually, my 4 hours could be made of, you know, two lots of 2 hours, or and quite routinely. I mean, I used to have a saying, and it's a bit of a hackney phrase within the community, that sleep's a weapon. So at every opportunity you get to get your head down, whether that be 10 minutes or whether that be, you know, a few hours, you take it. So it was not uncommon when I was in command of a submarine for me to turn around and tell my watchkeeping team, just, you know, don't interrupt me unless you absolutely need to. I'm going to get my head down. And I would go and have a couple of hours in the afternoon after lunch and just catch up, because I would know that something was going to happen in the night that was going to get me out of bed. And
Okay. Now that you're retired, do you still tell people what to do out of habit, or does that only happen at sea?
This is a really interesting one. I think there's a misnomer in outside of the military, in the civilian world, as perhaps you might call it, and that is that everybody in the military goes around barking orders and telling people what to do. And of course, you have the Naval Discipline Act or the Army Discipline Act, the Armed Forces Discipline Act, that sits behind you and backs you up and allows you to do that. But the moment that you have to revert to barking orders and threatening discipline, you've failed in your management or your leadership task. You know, your job in at sea is to get people to do the right thing and the things that need to be done. That's no different in business. Absolutely no different at all. And you have, you could almost say in the civilian world, we have the ultimate sanction, and that is you could lose your job. And actually in the armed forces, it's really difficult to lose your job. You know, even if you're not doing a good job and you're being disciplined, you're very unlikely to get thrown out of the Navy or thrown out of the armed forces. And so very rarely do you have to revert to that. And it's only because you've either got individuals who are problem children, and we all have those, or the other time that I would say you need to be directional is in times of criticality, in times particularly of safety, or in times of operational urgency. Then yes, you have to obviously take charge of the submarine, give direct orders, tell people what to do, because you need it to be done quickly and you need to be, there's an immediacy in it.
Would you say that the system works also because of the amount of time and money that's invested in recruitment and training though as well?
I think the system definitely works around training. We do, on the whole, recruit good people, specifically for certain roles. We absolutely make sure we've got the right people. And on the whole, we get that pretty right, I think, in the submarine service anyway. But there's a piece around culture, I think, and there's a complete synergy with business organizations as well. You set the culture, leadership sets the culture, your traditions set the culture, the way that you operate through years and years and years of experience sets the culture. And it's that culture actually which has people reacting to certain positions or individuals and responding, you know, to direction. That direction, of course, comes through the individuals on a submarine or a ship, indeed, having significant amounts of experience, significant capabilities that have been proven over years. And so that comes along with rank, but it also comes along with position. So, you know, the commanding officer, everybody in a submarine knows the commanding officer has passed the submarine command course, yeah, the Perisher course.
Yeah.
And that gives you a certain level of respect and credibility immediately.
Yeah. If we hired you, would the dress code need to be updated to full uniform at all times?
No, definitely not.
I mean, there is a significant importance, though, within the military to dress, isn't there? The different types of uniforms at the different types. What are the benefits of that?
Well, identity is one. The second is you don't have to worry about deciding what it is you're going to wear to work in the day.
Can be a problem.
It can be. The other thing I think, though, is there it provides a level of a standard, if you like. And I have to say that the military has changed with the times, as we all have had to change with the times. I remember, you know, joining the Navy in the 80s, and if you were in the Navy in the 60s or the 70s, you would probably have worn your service uniform, your what we would call our number one uniform most of the day. You might have relaxed your jacket if you were sat down in your chair in the office or on a ship. And in the evening, you would have put your mess dress on. And certainly if you were duty, you would have been in the bar and with your mess dress sort of showing that position of authority. Things have changed a bit. We now wear more practical, uniform at sea for all sorts of reasons. One is around the laundry of it, the maintenance of it. Two is around its properties for fire retardantness and things like that. And the other is around comfort and the ability to get in and out of it really quickly if you need to. So I think we've been very sensible about changing uniform. Some would say it's reduced standards, but most people, you know, the millennials would say it's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. It hasn't. The other thing is around civilian dress. And so you would have never gone into the wardroom without a jacket and a tie as an officer previously. Jeans were known as the devil's cloth.
Well, now full disclosure, Chris and I were at a very nice dinner in the City of London last night, and we heard from a guest speaker who talked about some of the terminology in the Navy. And my next question was actually, do we need to rename all the toilets heads? In any case, but so tell us some of those other fun pieces of language that came out last night.
Oh, there are so many. There is a.
I didn't realize there were so many.
There are so many, and genuinely, this is a bit of a plug. There is a book called Jack Speak, and I really recommend that anybody gets it. Buy it for your dad for Christmas or your mum for Christmas. It's a hilarious book, and it is naval language. It is absolutely the language that is in the Navy. It has a section on food. It has a section on everything. So, food is a particular area where, you know, sausages are snorkers. Sweet corn, a yellow peas. You've got, we have a breakfast menu, which is highly amusing, with bits and shits and tits and what it is spaghetti hoops in tomato sauce, tomatoes in tomato sauce, beans in tomato sauce, and that's all they say on
the way it came across last night was if you went into a mess room of a Royal Navy vessel, you wouldn't understand a word that was being spoken half the time.
There is a lot of it. There is a lot of it. You very quickly get into it, though. Yeah. And the same is true of nicknames. You know, Smith is always Smudge. Wright is always Shiner. You know, White is always Knocker. And there's lots and lots of them.
All right, final shock interview question. Most importantly, can you guarantee that nothing in this organisation will go nuclear on your watch?
I don't think there's any guarantees, are there? And the problem is external shocks, isn't it? And that's the same for business and the same for, you know, for defence. And you can never quite predict what the external shock is. And therefore, I don't think you can ever guarantee that you might not have to go nuclear. And that's... in the loose term of nuclear, you know, you have to do things sometimes which are extreme.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Chris, for participating in the shock interview. Okay, so the next section is the news. And for this week's news, there really is only one story worth talking about, and that is the autumn budget. It has landed with a thud across the small business community, and not in a good way. The Chancellor framed this budget as a supportive for entrepreneurs and local firms, but once you dig beneath the headlines, it becomes clear that most SMEs will not feel helped at all. Yes, there have been a few positive gestures. Business rates relief has been extended for retail, hospitality and leisure. There is also a new 3-year grace period before a company loses small business rates relief when it takes on a second site. These are welcome, but they are limited in their impact. The bigger issue is that several decisions in the budget actually increase the burden on small firms. One of the most controversial moves is the treatment of serviced offices and managed workspaces. The government will now classify these centres as a single large property for business rates purposes. That potentially means higher rates for the small companies who rely on flexible space to control their costs. It's the opposite of what most founders need right now. The budget also removed co-investment fees for apprentices under 25. That sounds positive, but in practice, it only helps a small subgroup of employers. It does nothing for the majority of SMEs who are facing rising payroll costs, recruitment challenges, and pressure on margins. Most importantly, the budget did not address the issues that matter most to small firms. There was no meaningful relief for energy costs, no action on rising insurance premiums, no increase in the employment allowance, no support for late payment problems, and nothing substantial to tackle weak demand. Many industry groups have described the whole package as a missed opportunity at a time when small businesses are already stretched. So the message this week is simple. The budget was not, in our opinion, SME friendly. It offered a handful of small wins, but failed to deal with the real pressures facing entrepreneurs across the UK. This is a moment when small businesses need stability, clarity, and proper support. Unfortunately, they did not get it. Now, Chris, I'm not going to put you on the spot too much on this score because you're not running a small business, but what sort of a sense do you get, just broadly, about how the budget played out?
If I look at
I should also say that we're trying not to be too political in this podcast. We're trying to be more factual than political.
Well, I'm glad that I am no longer employed in the way that I was previously, because I used salary sacrifice quite a lot, and of course that is
that was another thing that's been radically changed.
Yep. Changed, which is going to mean that how you pay into your pension, and if you have the luxury of being able to pay perhaps a little bit extra into your pension, is going to be another consideration, I think, for myself. Fundamentally, being retired, I think I probably retired at the right time.
I think you probably did, actually. Well done. Good time. All right, I won't put you on the spot any more than that. Okay, so now the main section, down to business. Now, you may be questioning why I've brought a Royal Navy captain, in brackets retired, into a small business podcast. But I was talking to Chris some months ago about this project, and I asked him whether he thought there were any similarities between commanding a submarine and running a small business. And he said, yes, absolutely there are. And silly man, that's why he's here today. Again, thank you very much for volunteering to come. How many something I should say is you obviously were privy to, and probably are privy to, some very, very sensitive stuff. So if I ask you a question that you feel you cannot answer, please just say, well, I could tell you that, but I'd have to kill you. Okay?
So I could tell you that, or I'd have to kill you.
Well, let's practice that. So what have you bought your wife, Claire, for Christmas?
Well, I could tell you that, but I'd have to kill you.
Right, there we go. Okay. back to seriousness. How many people roughly are there on a submarine?
You have about 138.
So a small business, as we've said a number of times, a small to medium enterprise in the UK is defined as up to 250 employees. So I think this is where we were going with this, is that if you take it just as a microcosm, you're banging the SME space. So when you said to me that leading a submarine and running a small business do share real similarities, what were the first parallels that came to mind?
Well, I think leadership, management, training, people development, it's all a human business. And individuals that are in the military and individuals that are in small and medium enterprises or indeed large endeavors are still motivated very largely in the same ways and require the same skills when it comes to leadership and management.
So very much synergy between the two. I mean, you as a naval commander would have often had to make decisions with limited information. How should a business handle that? When we're having to make decisions, we don't always have the full picture. So how do you handle that?
Well, I think you have to trust your experience, your training, and your judgment. And there are times where you have to make judgments, decisions. And there are times when you can afford to do significant amounts of analysis. And there are times when analysis is not, you either don't have the time to do it, or the decision is so important and so time critical that you need to make it quickly. In which case, you do have to revert to your your gut, your judge, your gut instinct. I always found that making sure you involve your team in decision making when you can is a really important thing to do.
That's an interesting point. And so one of the things that I'm finding fascinating about these conversations is that there are threads that are coming out. So a few weeks ago, we spoke to Annie Quigley, who's run Bibliophile Books for a long time. And she said a similar thing, involving the team in the understanding, in the decision-making process, so they understand why you're making those decisions. And that was something that she was quite passionate about as well. A small business owner often carries a big weight of responsibility. How does that compare with the responsibility of a naval commander, and what can owners learn from that?
Well, I think the consequences might be different, but in terms of responsibility, you know, looking after 138 people, a nuclear reactor, 5,000 tons worth of submarine, with a mission that you are tasked to do in places where you might create either political embarrassment or you might have to do really, you know, high risk things. You know, it sounds dramatic. I guess it's what it's about. But those decisions create an element of pressure, stress. I don't think they necessarily create any more pressure or stress than a young entrepreneur who's doing his best to support 2 people, 5 people, 10 people and their livelihoods and their families, and trying to create his own business and success. And so therefore, I think in many ways, the how you deal with that are very similar. Just the consequences are slightly different.
Yeah, 100% the consequences are different, but you know, stress is relative, I guess, isn't it? It's your lived experience, as a stock phrase at the moment, is going to be very relevant here.
And those consequences could be equally catastrophic in that individual's eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. Your business is at risk. Your employers are. I mean, I remember when I started the business, I would pay myself a day after everybody else to make sure that all the payments had gone through, to make sure that the payroll was safe before I took any money myself. And you have the weight of that responsibility all the way through.
I think, you know, you can make good decisions, though, as long as you understand the mission. And our mission is sounds like a military term, but actually, you know, it's really not. And, you know, most big companies and most companies will have a mission, a vision, aims, objectives. And as long as you and your team all understand what the mission is.
I really like that. I think that's a really good piece of advice, actually, to understand the mission. Do you think sometimes businesses have lost sight of their mission recently?
Oh, I don't know whether or not the whole business has lost sight of the mission. You would hope not. But I think quite often that mission does not get translated to the workforce. And I'll talk about what we used to call mission command and delegation. And when you're making decisions that need to be made really rapidly, need to be made remotely, it's identical in business as it is in the military. In that, if you arm your people with the mission, the vision, the sense of direction, they'll make good decisions in the absence of you not being there to give them direction and guidance. They will know what you want them to do fundamentally, and so they'll make good decisions. They'll certainly make better decisions.
I think that's fantastic advice. And leaders in small teams often worry about morale. How did you maintain calm and focus in those enclosed, stressful conditions? And how can an SME owner use similar principles?
I think people are what deliver success in the business, whatever business you're in. And very much, I'm a big proponent of look after your people and your people look after you. I'm a really big proponent in that. So you want your people to be happy in their roles, you know, feeling fulfilled, a sense of purpose. You want them to have as good a work-life balance as they can have. Most people, I think, if you give them rational argument, will understand when they've got to put the nose to the grindstone and get on and deliver. And there's a time when you can afford to be slightly less dictatorial and perhaps give a little bit more latitude. And there are times when you can't. And in business, that might be, I suppose, in the closing stages of a bid process or a negotiation. There's a time where you've just got to get your nose to the grindstone and deliver. And then there are times, perhaps, when it's less critical. And what I think people really want is their management, their leaders, to recognize when those times are and to reward people when they deserve reward. And if they feel they're going to get that, then generally they'll turn to you.
How does a small business, though, because in the military you've got the command structure, you've got the discipline, you've got the traditions, you've got the uniform to fall back on when you need to bring it on, when you need to get the nose to the grindstone, when you need to enforce the discipline. A small business on Civvy Street doesn't necessarily have that. So how can a small business owner channel that without those advantages?
Well, I think you have to build those advantages and build them quickly. So I think you've got to understand what do you want your business to look like? What's the culture you want in your business? And you have to then set the values that are important to you and important to the business, and you have to live by them. You cannot turn around in management speak and create a set of, you know, a mission, a vision, a set of aims. This is our culture. This is our...
Just a tick box.
Yeah, these are our values. And you put it up as wallpaper all over your office, and then you don't live them. And you don't hold other people to account and live them. And I think leaders need to understand their leadership footprint.
What do you mean by that?
What do they leave behind when they leave the room? What do they leave behind when they're behaving in a particular way? You cannot turn around and ask your staff to cut back on travel and subsistence and not spend quite so much money on the dinner in the hotel if they know that you, as the managing director, the CEO, the owner, whatever your position you're in, are going out to the Ritz-Carlton and traveling first class. And your leadership footprint is, what I mean by that is, how do people perceive you? How do people see you behaving? Are you living the values that you expect them to live? Because they're not going to do it if you're not.
In your experience, what behaviours show you that someone will thrive under pressure? How can you spot them? I'm thinking a little bit of the recruitment process, and something that we're focusing on a little bit more this year is when we interview people, not necessarily looking at their skills, not looking at what is written down on their CV, but how they come across, what their attitude is. What are the key things that people should be looking out for as these really great team players that are going to help you build your business?
I think probably it's the activities and things that individuals have done outside of formal education and work to an extent. So what are their interests? What have they done in life? What, certainly when I was sifting, you know, applications for interview, I was assuming almost that the applicant would have the qualifications that I needed them to have to do the role. And so when it came to sifting, I was far more interested in the other interests that they had done. And what I was looking for really were people that were self-starters, people that were adventurous, people, because those types of people tend to be more comfortable with risk, more comfortable with making decisions because they've had to for themselves. Team players, yes, things like captain of the rugby team, that sort of thing, that demonstrates clear desire to lead, and generally means that they're good with people. And I think you cannot be a good leader if you're not good with people.
How do you weigh risk? Part of the premise of this podcast is I fully accept that I've made mistakes over the years, and I would say that one of the mistakes that I've made is that I've been too risk averse sometimes. I was brought up by someone who was extremely risk averse, God rest her soul, and that very much rubbed off on me. But how do you weigh risk and make sure that you balance risk and rewards correctly?
I suppose a lot of taking risk comes from experience. And it's when you're taking risk and you don't have that experience, you start to move into gamble territory. So I always look at risk as risk is a calculated decision. You might not be able to know the exact elements of that calculation. But as soon as you start to get to a 50-50, then you're moving into gambling territory. So you're no longer taking risk, you're gambling. When you move into gambling territory, I start to worry. There are some times when you don't, where things are a 50-50 and you're taking a gamble on things. And many entrepreneurs have been extraordinarily successful because they've taken a bit of a gamble.
They've taken that gamble. But I like that point at where it's not a risk anymore, it's a gamble, and the difference between those two words. I like that.
And the other thing about risk is the juice has to be worth the squeeze. So why are you taking the risk?
Yes.
What is the outcome that you want or need? And so sometimes there was a great thing in the submarine command course about risk, and what the example is: you're at the top of a cliff, and you have an elastic band around your waist, attached to a rock, and that elastic band allows you to go to the edge of the cliff, and it allows you to be able to look over the cliff, and what you need is to understand what's at the bottom of the cliff. How far do you lean out? How far are you prepared to lean out? And that is determined, one, in your personal capabilities. You know, if you're too heavy and it's going to snap the band, there's no point doing it too far. You know, understanding your personal, what I mean by that is you need to understand your personal abilities and your personal capabilities. And some individuals can take more risks personally than others because they're more capable, they're quicker, they're whatever, they have a particular skill potentially. But the thing to understand is, you know, sometimes it might be really critical to know all of the information that's at the bottom of the cliff. Sometimes it might just be nice to know it. And so how much risk are you going to take? How far are you going to lean out? And how are you going to make sure the elastic doesn't snap? And it's a good way, I think, of understanding risk
and visualizing it.
Yeah.
Looking back, what lesson from your career would you give to a new business owner who's about to take command of their first team?
Really know your own capabilities. Understand your team's capabilities. And if you don't, make it your goal to understand your team's capabilities. And then delegate. That is my biggest piece of advice, would be delegate. And then delegate once, go back and delegate again, and delegate until you're really uncomfortable. And you'll be really amazed at how people react to that.
Yeah. This is something that I've struggled with and other people I've worked with have struggled with. People who are a little bit on the perfectionist side, delegating can be very, very hard. But I think that's absolutely spot on.
If you want to expand your business, if you want to be really, truly successful, if you want your people to be motivated and to do well as in the organization and in their own lives, full stop, you have to delegate. Absolutely have to delegate. And there are two great reasons for it. One is resilience. So, and this links into training, I think. If your number two can't do your job, what happens when you're not there?
Yeah.
What happens if you can't be there? Is one that's really important. And the other thing is you need the ability to be able to do strategic thinking and to really give yourself the time to think about the business and to think about what it is you need to do and to do the up and out kind of engagement. And if you're too involved in the business, you're too involved in the decision-making process, you're too involved in every single piece of paper needs your approval and needs to come across your desk, how do you go on holiday? How do you how do you do the things which keep you sane, which are, it's all about mindfulness, it's about the success of the business, it's about the development of your people. Delegation is absolutely key to it.
Okay, that's brilliant. Okay, we need to move on. I asked you to come up with a competition question. So Labyrinth Technology is giving away a Samsung Galaxy Tab A9 to anybody who gets all the questions right that are answered in this season. You can go to the website blueprinttoboom.com to enter the competition questions. Terms and conditions are on the website, and the competition closes on the 31st of December 2025. So, Chris, what's your competition question?
My question. The Royal Navy operates 11 nuclear submarines. They're split into two groups. One is an attack submarine, which is nuclear powered and conventionally armed. The other is an SSBN, a ballistic nuclear missile firing submarine. They are two classes of submarine. What are the two classes called?
What are the two classes of submarine called that the Royal Navy currently operates? Brilliant. Thank you very much. I said that we would come quickly back to your current role as Master of the Worshipful Company of Tinplate Workers, alias Wire Workers of the City of London, one of the ancient livery companies. The purpose of this podcast is not to talk about the City of London or the livery companies, but the livery companies are, in a way, a small business in their own right. So just in a couple of minutes, tell us about how you're enjoying the experience and how positive you feel about the livery movement.
Well, I retired in order to make the most of my year as the Master Tinplate Worker. I am now about a third of the way through it, and my wife and I are having an absolute ball doing it. It's a real privilege to lead the organisation for a year and to represent the organisation, which is more important. I'm really proud of what it is our organisation and the other 113 livery companies do. So yes, we support the City of London, but we support all of the trades that we're responsible for and involved in. And we support them in all kinds of ways, around awards for excellence in industry, but also for graduates and apprenticeships. And it's amazing what we do in terms of supporting our trade. The other piece that we do is charitable work. And I think the livery companies give something like £80 million a year.
It won't be long before it's nearly £100 million pounds a year that the livery movement as a whole gives to charity, which is huge. I think actually something we were talking about last night, I think the livery companies, if you take the livery movement as one thing, it's one of the top 10 charitable givers in the UK.
It's an amazing organisation, it really is. And our company itself, We're a relatively small company, but we still manage to disperse about £80,000 a year to all manners of charities, which is a really satisfying thing to be sort of at the head of for a year. And then in terms of the sort of third pillar of activity, it's around fellowship and fun. And so we get together about five times a year, and we have some really nice dinners and some great places. And we've got some tremendous people, and it's just a nice thing to do. Occasionally we dress up, and that's good. And we all enjoy each other's company.
100%. Thank you very much, Chris. Moving on to the final section. Okay, we are asking all our guests to give our community three actionable things that they can put into practice to help them run their business. Three blueprint bullets to go on the website. So, Chris, what are your three blueprint bullets?
My first blueprint bullet is...
Don't worry, it took me a few times in the mirror to get that right. Blueprint bullet.
My first blueprint bullet is delegation and mission command. I've spoken a bit about delegation and talked about the importance of delegation, but mission command is also really important. Know the mission and make sure that your team know the mission, right down to the lowest levels of within the team, because that way they'll make the right decisions. My second bullet is around training and development. Train your team. It gives you resilience. It motivates them. It allows them to flourish, and it means that you can have more space to do the really important thinking around running your business. And the third piece, my third bullet, is clarity and consistency. Make sure that people understand, one, what the business is doing, two, what their role is, what they need to do, and the direction of travel that you want to go in.
And you used the word consistency, and this is brilliant. I love this, because this is another thread that is coming through episode after episode. Is it in all sorts of ways how important consistency is?
I think consistency in your expectations and your style is really important. Otherwise, how do people react? How do people know when you're genuinely angry, if you're angry all the time? And also, people need to be able to predict what the consequences of what's happened in the business are going to be, and what your likely response is going to be as a leader. And therefore, what should we do to avoid those scenarios? There is nothing worse than working for somebody who is unpredictable.
Yeah.
You can work for somebody who is a complete tyrant, but if you know that's what he's like or she's like, you can deal with it. But if you deal with somebody who you walk into an office and you have no idea what response you're going to get, what reaction you're going to get, what mood you're going to get in, how you're going to be treated, it's very disconcerting and really bad for business.
Absolutely right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode and to the end of season one of Blueprint to Boom. We launched this project and the ambition was simple. We wanted to give small business owners the sort of practical, honest, experience-driven advice that genuinely makes a difference in the real world, the kind of insight that cuts through the noise and helps you take your ideas from blueprint to boom. This season, I've had the privilege of sitting down with a wonderful group of guests: Matthew Dunn from Labyrinth Technology, Margaret Anthony from Hardcastle Burton, Tomas Biro from Netzol, Annie Quigley from Bibliophile Books, Elaine Davis from EJD Consulting, and of course, huge thanks to our very own submarine captain, Chris Groves. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Each guest has brought something unique, whether it was lessons learned the hard way or stories that remind us that running a business is as much about the people as it is about the process, something that I think come through very much from you today, Chris. And I want to thank every one of them for their time. And I know that even though you're retired, your time is a precious commodity this year. So thank you. I also want to thank Henry, the producer, and Adam from Podcast Room London Bridge, who've made a huge contribution and made the process so seamly and friendly. They are definitely part of the family. But most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. Blueprint to Boom was created to serve the small business community, and I hope that you have found value in these conversations. We will be back. The next chapter is already being planned, and I cannot wait to bring you more guests, more practical guidance, and more of the conversations that matter to founders and business leaders across the UK. Until then, keep building, keep learning, and keep moving your business forward. Thank you for being part of season one. I will see you in season two, but until then, farewell.